This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Hello, friends. How are you, friends? This is Community or Chaos, and today we have Mike Joy, a well-known environmentalist, particularly around water and the issues related to water, but also in the environment generally, and dealing with climate change and other environmental issues that we've managed to ignore for the last 40 years or so. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, thanks very much for having me along.
Mike, is New Zealand's green image false advertising? And if so, why?
Yeah, it couldn't be further from the truth, actually. If you look at rankings based on our environmental performance, we rank in the bottom 25% of 180-odd countries in the world when it comes to our environmental performance. We have the highest proportion of threatened species in the world. We can talk about it later, maybe, but a bunch of our rivers have more nitrogen flux going through them than the worst rivers in the world. You know, we have our per capita greenhouse gas emissions are amongst the worst. If you look at the country overshoot days, you know, in April we exceed the capacity of the planet to absorb our lifestyles, so we go into deficit throughout the rest of the year. We're in credit up until April, and then from then on. And you look at the bunch of countries that are around us, and they're the most polluting in the world. So, yep, there's nothing green except the green paddocks that are green because we put lots of fertilizer on them. And, of course, the conservation estate, which is a real gem. It's under a lot of threat. But it's very non-representative, you know, like it's a third of the land area roughly, but it's not a representative third. It's basically the third of the country where nobody could build farms or cities. And so it's what got left over. So it's basically mountains that are in the conservation estate and protected to some extent, maybe not now with mining, but supposedly protected. So yeah, no way could we be considered green.
Okay. Well, friends, if you're interested in podcasting this, you can go to oar.org.nz and then go to podcasting doing Community or Chaos. Well, we're talking with Mike Joy, an environmentalist, about what New Zealand faces if we're going to be somewhat attuned to our green image. We're going to try to make a change. We have to start thinking about what kind of change do we need. And we've been talking about problems of water purity and safe drinking water for some time. Is the situation getting better? If not, why not?
No, it's getting worse. We're starting to get, you know, regional councils like Canterbury declaring a nitrate emergency, and Southland is really bad. Otago's getting there. But it just comes, it's pretty simple if you just step back a bit, that we have industrialized farming, particularly dairy farming. And finally, I think it's making the news and people's realization that we are dependent on fossil fuel derived nitrogen fertilizer shipped from the Middle East, more than three quarters of it from the Middle East. We have a little plant in Taranaki that converts our gas, what's left of it, into nitrogen fertilizers. Just to kind of clarify, nitrogen's abundant in the atmosphere, but it's not in a usable form for plants. And 100-odd years ago, a couple of German scientists figured out how you can use fossil fuels to turn that nitrogen in the atmosphere into reactive nitrogen to grow plants. Of course, nature's been doing that forever, but we've figured out a way of using fossil fuels. So we kind of take stored energy from millennia and turned it into fossil fuels today, pour it onto the land, grows grass, cows eat grass, a tiny amount of the nitrogen goes out into the milk. Some goes into the cow, but not, more than 75% of it goes excreted straight out the other end of the cow through urine and then down onto the ground where it's at such high density it can't be taken up by the plant. So it goes down through the soils and ends up in our groundwater or laterally across or down and then back up into rivers again. But it makes its way into our waterways, our lakes, our estuaries, our oceans. And that then it starts to cause real problems. And drinking water, we have significant emerging issues around cancers with high nitrate levels in drinking water, particularly colorectal cancer. And New Zealand has the highest rates of colorectal cancer in the world, as well as some of the highest rates of nitrogen and water in the world. So I don't think it's not just a coincidence. It's a real phenomena. And so that's the big driver. It's that industrialization of farming taking ancient fossil energy, turning it into fertilizer to grow lots of grass so you can have really high densities of cows and pump out more and more milk from the land.
I always feel like that's a shame. When I was young growing up, dairy farming was one of the things you could do that seemed like a good thing to do and a fairly reasonable thing to do.
Yeah,
A
yeah.
so-called family farm. In fact, I've got
Yeah, yeah.
a friend who still does 70 cows
Well,
and farms.
that's what I grew up with
He
too.
manages to make a
That's,
living. He's not he's
yeah.
certainly not getting rich, and he struggles because he's dealing with this competition is
Yeah,
industrialized.
yeah, yeah. But I
But
mean, it's the same with me. I mean, I grew up on a dairy farm and, 80 cows supported a couple of families. It's not like it wasn't money in those days. It's like all these things, it just gets more intensified. It's not that people make any more money. In fact, I don't think it's changed hugely. The money is made in capital gains on the increase in value of the land more than the actual farming. But yeah, and
I would disagree. I would say that corporations, and I
oh
think
yeah, of
in
course,
some
yeah.
ways, Fonterra is more of a corporation than a cooperative in its.
Oh yeah, it makes the money, but not the farmers themselves. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's yeah.
so money is the reason for the intensification. It's just the money doesn't necessarily go to the farmer.
Yeah, and
Though
I
the
just to
farmers are
give you an
doing quite
idea.
well, to be
Yeah, they
honest.
well, I know quite a few of them and they don't do all that well, but they do. They're billionaires or they're multi-millionaires when they sell their farms.
Isn't
The
that one
ones
of
that
the
still
problems
own them.
is you can't really plan on your family inheriting the farm if you want to sell it?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean,
And
but you know, when
do
we're
the
talking
farms
about
end
these,
up being owned overseas in many cases?
yeah, in lots of cases they do. But those recent, like Canterbury and Southland, where they were recently turned into dairy, that was all about capital gains. That's about buying some cheap land, converting it to dairy, and massively increasing that land value, and then no tax on capital gains, meaning that's the investment for your future.
I can remember when New Zealand grew more, most of, oh, all its own oats and most of its wheat.
Yeah, no, well, it's the same thing. We've kind of offshored, globalized everything now. So, I mean, we started off, all of our nitrogen fertilizer came from Kapuni, and that was, and you can go back a step and see where that came from, the Think Big scheme, where the gas prospectors, Shell, BP, Todd, had the government over a barrel saying, with a take or pay scheme, so we will prospect this gas, we will put it ashore for you, but you'll take or pay this amount. And so part of that led to the government at the time having to do something with all the gas because they were going to pay for it anyway. So they set up the plant, the urea plant at Kapuni, which then meant that they had not. And I mean, New Zealand farmers hadn't known nitrogen fertilizer up until then. Suddenly, you've got nitrogen fertilizer, and then everyone's hooked on it because once you start using it, if you stop using it, you're in trouble because you change the whole microbiology of the soil, and once you start this additive, you're kind of locked into it like a. Like a heroin addict, once you start, it's very, very hard to stop. And so that was how it started slowly. And, prior to that, back when we were talking about the small farms, we were one cow per hectare roughly on a dairy farm in New Zealand. And now in parts of Southland and Canterbury, it's up to 4 cows per hectare. So that's that gives you an indication of just how extreme the intensification that was allowed by bringing in palm kernel phosphate and synthetic nitrogen fertilizer as well. So that industrialization.
Should we be more skeptical of how we use technology and what technology we accept?
Oh, of course we should, but we've got a history of just I mean, of course, when Haber-Bosch, realized you could make reactive nitrogen, everybody thought it was a miracle and what a fantastic thing.
Well, you can
And
see
now,
why they thought that.
at the time you think it's fantastic because you can't win. The same with fossil fuels, seems like such a labor-saving fantastic idea, and then somewhere along the road reality hits and you have polluted rivers, lakes, and dead zones off oceans and climate change. And so then it's kind of when it's too late we realize, hang on, that wasn't such a good idea after all.
What would you do with dairy farming, say, if you were Prime Minister, which isn't likely and probably isn't one of your wishes? I
It
mean,
wouldn't be something.
how do you change something in a way that doesn't do lots of harm?
Oh, I don't think that's hard to do at all. I think, I mean, it's pretty simple that if you have to bring stuff in to grow your food, from the outside, then your problem, your food, your production system is wrong. You've got sunlight and rainwater, and that's where the energy comes in and nutrients in the soil. And if you close the loop and, keep all of that on the farm, the only loss is the stuff that you're selling, but you can replace that by composting and natural fertilizers. I mean, then permaculture is the goal. You know,
How do
that's
you
the gold
encourage that to
standard.
happen without?
Oh, well, you've got to start making people pay for their harm. You have to have a tax on methane or climate harming emissions. You have to have a there's so many different ways you can do it, but you have to have the price being paid by the harming organization, not by the general public having to pay the price for the
Well,
harm
maybe
that's
what you
done.
should do is have your carbon taxes and nitrate taxes, but also have schemes for people changing how they do things.
Well, I mean that would
People will
be
probably need help with making the turnaround.
but as soon as you see, at the moment you can't. If you do the right thing, you're penalized because your neighbor's getting subsidized to do it. We have to think about it as a subsidy. What we're doing at the moment is subsidizing harmful farming by not making that harmful farmers pay for the harm that they do. We're effectively subsidizing it. I mean, I can it was it's so clear and simple in New Zealand that we have two lakes where. So Lake Taupō and Lake Rotorua, we pay farmers millions of dollars to not have cows in those catchments to protect those lakes. So we have the precedent that's been set now, $400 for every kilogram of nitrogen emitted or leached from those farms is what the farmers are compensated for to get the cows off the farms. In other words, we subsidize dairy farming in New Zealand and all the places where we don't do that to the tune of $400 for every kilogram of nitrogen lost. And just to put that into some kind of perspective, just for Canterbury alone, that would be a $12 billion yearly subsidy given to Canterbury dairy farmers, because if that's the amount of nitrogen that they leach out into the freshwater environment every year. So it's not just a small subsidy, it is a massive subsidy. And if you took that subsidy away, so that's our choice. We've let it get this far, so if we want to stop that from happening, then the way to do it would one way to do it would be to do that example from those two lakes, where you fi pay farmers not to have dairy, not to have animals at that intensity, and then they find other things that they can do with the land, and you save your fresh water.
So it's a matter of carrot and stick, and which one you're using, or if you're using a combination.
Yeah, well, I mean, but it's like all these things, though. If you do nothing, if you just wait for the crisis, well, the Hormuz situation is the crisis, and our stocks of fertilizer are going to get very low very soon, and farmers are going to be trapped with high stocking rates and high densities, and no ability to feed them because they don't have the fertilizer, because they're locked into this globalized food system. Fertilizer necessity. So yeah, I think that some of the reality, a bit like I'm sure that you'll see a reduction in the amount of emissions coming from transport and all sorts of things happening here at the moment. As fuel gets more and more expensive, people will use their cars and trucks less, and then you're kind of forced. And I would much rather we managed our way down and we looked at this and could see that this is a huge risk for us, and we're locked into a system that's totally unsustainable, and we manage our way out of it before the crisis. But I suspect that we don't, and the crisis is looming at the moment.
It seems to me we haven't managed our future with. We've had the philosophy that the market will manage it. And has the market managed our environment well?
No, yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that the market has utterly failed us. That is the problem, is the market.
But we're still committed to not governing, but letting the market govern, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's our downfall. Clearly, I call it the cult of capitalism, and like anyone in a cult, we're not aware that we're in a cult, and it rules everything, and it is incredibly destructive.
What do you, when you think about water, what do you think about data banks?
Oh, the data storage. I mean, they're part of a,
Do
they're
you have
another
anything to
symptom.
say? Should we have a big data storage in Southland?
No,
Is that the
that's the,
salvation of Southland?
no, that's the opposite. It's the worst thing for Southland,
Okay, tell
possibly.
us
It's just,
how.
well, just it's going to need and require incredible amounts of energy, and it's not going to be renewable energy. Well, apart from hydro, you can't run data centers on solar and wind because they're intermittent, and data centers require constant amounts of energy. The water is another issue where it's used for cooling. It's not as if it disappears. It's used to cool down, which is just an indication of the stupidity of it, that you're making all this heat, then you're using beautiful water to cool it down again. Whereas all those houses down there in wintertime could do with that heat, but of course we never think about things like that. But it's a road to nowhere. The future of humankind will not.
What's the future of data banks and the net and the way it's developed? I'm not talking about emails.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, just
I mean,
I only have to look at my own phone and the number of photos of my dog and my boat and things like that. There are all thousands of them, and on my computer, all the papers I download that are all sitting in data centers somewhere, and think of every other person like me who's just amassing massive amounts of data requirement, let alone, AI and large language models and all of the
but that
that
AI
they
and so
need.
on helps make our use of the computers a product. That's why we don't have to pay for certain things, because it goes into advertising, personalized advertising.
Yeah, that's right. It's all,
well, I would
it's all part of that same
that
thing.
In 20 years, we won't have it.
Well, I hope you're right there. I think that the best thing that could happen is that we don't have the internet and we'd actually get some reality back to lives. But
well, we can't afford the internet because of the carbon use, because of the environmental impact, and because of the cost of keeping them running.
No, I agree, and I think bring it on. The sooner it disappears, the better. But I think that we're in a very small minority there.
Well, that's the facts of the matter are what will shut it down. It won't be shut down because I don't want to make amazing profits, super profits anymore. So I'll be more careful what I do with my you know, internet and so on. That's not going to happen. But what will happen is that it'll become so much more costly to run it that they'll go down. Because
well, that's exactly what's going to happen with the nitrogen, you know, the fertilizer and farming systems. It's not like they're voluntarily going to do it. It's the fact that there isn't any more coming that is going to.
But the government should plan for this, shouldn't it?
Oh, of course they should. Yeah. But this is where governments are not. They get voted in, you know, for popularity reasons, for telling people nice, happy stories. And this kind of reality that we're talking about, no political party's going to talk about this kind of reality because they'll lose votes in the process. I mean, even the lovely, my friends at the Green Party, you know, they can never talk about these kind of realities because they'll lose votes in the process. So.
Do you think the people in Europe before the UK was invaded, do you think some of those countries were talking about it seriously?
I don't know. I guess there were factions within it, but
I know, for instance, that almost all cars in Norway are electric cars.
Yeah, well, that's all very nice for Norway because they made huge amounts of money from oil. Yeah, so if you're rich, you can afford an electric vehicle, and it's cheap motoring for you. But it's just putting all of the costs on the rest of society, all the mining, all of the materials. You know, most of those EVs are, you know, nearly 3 tons in weight now. Think of all of the steel and plastic and those rare earth metals and everything that go into those vehicles. You know, that it's not some
should we switch
great green thing.
More public transport, really.
Oh yeah, I mean that's clearly the way to go, but that doesn't work in rural New Zealand, does it? It's a solution for urban areas.
Well, you should go for the urban areas first.
Oh yeah. Oh, I'm not saying don't do it.
And also we've actually cut back on railway lines that used to serve rural areas.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, if you look at the old railway network, we had a massive, beautiful railway network that should be still up and running, and it should be carrying freight as well as people, not, you know, the explosion of huge trucks on our roads is crazy.
Or should that be part of what politics is about?
Yeah, but I don't know. How do you do that, though, when people, see, humans are naturally kind of, you know, and naturally lazy. If you give us a cheap and easy option, we'll take it.
I think that may be wrong. I think that we're affected by our culture. Right?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, you look at what our culture says about the importance of money, the importance of growth, and the importance of, when we think of freedom, we think of free enterprise. We don't think of freedom.
No, you're right.
So if you believe that human beings can change for the better, why, then we'll try harder to make that change happen. If you believe we're naturally greedy and naturally evil, it's hard to work for change.
Yeah, but it's just looking around at what's happened. That's where the belief come from. But I know that
but
you're right.
You live in a society that loves growth and loves and says that money is the most important value in the world.
Mm.
It hasn't always been that way.
No, I know, that's for sure.
So
no, it doesn't need to be that way, but that's what we've got at the moment. That's the cult of capitalism.
But we assume that capitalism is the norm.
Mm.
And capitalism isn't the norm. It's been the norm for the last 100 or 200 years, but it hasn't always been the norm.
No, exactly. I mean, I'm
talk not
about
saying
it.
We've had great societies in the past, but we've had different societies in the past.
You know, I talk about our crisis of imagination, and that's the thing that I see, that people can't imagine a world that isn't like this, because this is all we've ever known and all our parents have known, so we think this is the way it has to be. And trying to imagine a different world is a big struggle.
How long do you think this crisis in transport and supply is going to last?
I've got no idea, but I know that even if the strait opened tomorrow, there's going to be a huge lag effect of getting everything back online again, and you know, lots of the infrastructure that's been destroyed back online again. So there's going to be a big hole coming.
Why hasn't the coalition government talked about this? And why do they assume that in, you know, weeks' time or a few months' time, the oil will be back at the same price and is available, and everything else will be back to the old norm?
Oh, I couldn't explain that. I can't understand almost anything that comes out of that place.
I mean,
it's
know, it's not. It's probably we may still be in crisis in November.
Oh, I'm sure it'll go longer than that. And yeah, I mean,
why in the heck would the government tell you differently when they know they're facing an election, and by November, if it's still in crisis, it'll be worse. We'll be hurting.
Yeah, but I think that their advisors, their PR people, tell them that, you know, just sound positive all the time. Just make it sound like you're confident and you sound positive, because then the voters will vote for you. So this is their only possible strategy, because if they start talking about reality, then they'll be in trouble.
Well, they're going to be in trouble anyway, because reality is going to hit us.
I know. That's like everything we've got, with kind of every conclusion of everything we've talked about. Yeah. The trouble's coming. You can't avoid it, but we're just going to kind of pretend in the meantime, and you know, every day will be
leaders
will be
that pretend aren't leaders.
I know. That's just
do
leaders
we need to actually govern for the common good?
Yeah, well, this is. I mean, we've got a symposium coming up. You know, kind of a reality check symposium at Victoria University soon, and the reality of everything it's called, and we're going to have a big session on deliberative government and other, you know, options that we have, because clearly the system we have at the moment doesn't work. So there's you know, outside of my expertise, but I can see clearly that we need another system, because this one has proven to be fatal.
Would that be online?
We're hoping to make it online. Yeah,
that's terrible, isn't it?
I'm really talking
about the reality of online use, and I want to take part in this.
I know. Well, it's the same thing, and we've sold out the 300 seats that we've got. I mean, so you could either do it online, or you could come to Wellington. You figure out which is more harmful out of those things, you know. that's the kind of tough reality of the world that we're in, isn't it? But we've got to try what we do what we can.
One of the things that sometimes has made me sore about environmentalists, not so much now, but earlier, agreed that we're overpopulated. But I don't think people – I think you have to value human beings as well as other life.
Mm-hmm.
And when people righteously say that we're going to – two-thirds of the population is going to go because of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Well, if that may be the trend. That may happen. But we should look at it with grief, not with glee or righteousness.
Mm.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think anyone's, I don't know that anyone's celebrating that
No,
reality.
but
They're
they
just
keep.
talking about it as a reality.
Well, sometimes people talk about it as a reality and with a certain righteousness.
No, I don't know. I certainly don't feel like that because
Yeah, I'm
I
sure
know
you don't.
that 50% of New Zealand's population are in the top 10% of wealth globally. So half of us are in the 10% that do 70% of the harm to the planet. So if there was any culling of people on the planet to try and save the life supporting capacity of the planet, it's that 10% that we're in that should be getting the chop if
It's
you were
not,
going to do
that's not
it.
what's going to happen. I can
No, I
see it
know. It's
happening.
the opposite. Yeah, it's the opposite is what's going to happen.
And this is bad for humanity. It's bad for what makes us. I think part of what makes us human is empathy. And I also think that empathy isn't necessarily, I think it's part of consciousness, but I suspect it's the dolphins and wolves may have empathy.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. But that kind of the thing about thinking about humans and our future is the inevitable reality will be that things are going to get harder and harder, and food is going to become more scarce. And we have this incredibly high population. Well, I mean, it's happened because, in part or a big part, because of taking energy from the past and fossil fuels and turning it into food today through that fertilizer that I was talking about. So, if you look at how much nitrogen is in our food, synthetic nitrogen, then you can show under our current diets that our planet could only support 3 billion people.
What if we were? I'm not a vegetarian, I should be.
No.
But what if we were all vegetarian?
Oh, well, that would then the planet could feed us. Yeah, it's the trouble is that most of that fertilizer is going into animals, not into
So
food directly.
maybe meat should be rationed.
Yeah, oh, there's lots of things that should be rationed. I mean,
I'm
if we,
serious.
yeah, no, I'm serious too. I've been a vegetarian for at least 30
Well,
years, and
my children are vegetarian,
yeah,
and
but they haven't convinced you yet.
well,
That's
they should have. I mean, I should have be convinced.
But it's never
Some
that simple. But
habits die hard.
sure. Yeah, but that's just, isn't that proof of how hard it is to change,
Yeah,
though?
it is. I'm not denying that. But I think that part of people when they run for office, for instance, they acknowledge they want to be lead the country. Well, leadership should have courage and truthfulness.
Yep. You're so
And
right. And that's really lacking, isn't it? Yeah, you can just see with some of our ministers at the moment who, like Mr. Pro Mining Jones, who you can look back 20 years and he was the most anti-mining minister in government.
Well,
They're
you've got
just
to ask
so.
yourself, under our present system, who funds the political parties?
Oh yeah, that's a big part of it, but it's also about that individual power trip that some of them are on as well. That there's their own ego and self-importance that they get caught up in. Yeah, it's clearly a utterly failed system. You have to look at Trump to see how our current democratic system is an utter failure.
Actually, when I look at Trump, I also look at Musk and a guy
Oh,
named
yeah.
Peter Thigh.
Yes, another one coming
Yeah,
down
he's
here,
one.
isn't
But the
he?
thing about their sense of entitlement, their sense of ego, narcissism is quite strong. In fact, somebody did I think Victoria University did a study of narcissism in careers, and they discovered that commerce and law had the highest rate of narcissism. I don't know how scientific that was, but they
No,
had.
I'm sure that makes sense to me, yeah.
But the system that says that getting rich is the meaning of life is certainly going to create a certain strong sense of entitlement.
Yeah, for sure.
And if you look at people that have done a lot of good for the world and someone like Martin Luther King or Gandhi, you don't get that sense of personal entitlement. And it's personal, the idea that what makes me important is how much wealth I can gather. So you got to ask, where did they get their sense of humanity? And how can we encourage a sense of a collective caring for each other and for the planet, a sort of idea of the common good that includes the planet and life?
Yeah. Well, I wonder about how much of that, Marvin, comes from marketing. I mean, there's a paper, I don't know if you've read it, that we did last year on behavior change and how much we're influenced by marketing. Maybe we could share the link to it in the it's a publicly available peer-reviewed paper. But, you know, how much of it is an innate human thing and how much of it is just marketing that plays on innate, you know, human characteristics to make us think that having all this stuff is important. And, you know, look at the success. It always strikes me that just look around at the number of four-wheel drive utes that every guy in New Zealand feels like they have to own, regardless of any need for it. And you just see I look at TV occasionally, like for sports or something like that, and every other ad is for a new Ford Ranger ute, and you can see just how much, you know, advertising influences people. So that's another place where
I'll show my age. I remember the 70s in Whanganui.
Yeah.
And many families, they had a good bus, reasonably good bus system, especially for a small town then. And a lot of families didn't bother to have cars, and no families, or very, very few families had more than one car.
Yes. No, I grew up in that time as well, yeah.
And I look around me now in my working-class neighborhood, and that we'd have off-street parking. And just about every house has two or three cars.
Well, we've got the highest rate of car ownership in the world per capita. So, yeah, we love our cars here.
In the late 30s and early 40s, it might have been even earlier than that, the people that pioneered marketing were saying how it would help with the growth of capitalism, how it would how we had to market if we wanted to grow. So what you said about marketing is quite true. It's part of the process. It's one of those things that should be looked at.
Yeah.
What kind of society do we need if we want to drastically slow down the economy, economic growth, and expect people to accept slow or no growth economy in a world that continues?
Yeah, we
have
clearly
a great amount of growing inequality.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know how you do the change. I can see that we have to be there, and it will happen inevitably because of resource constraints and energy constraints. We will get there. I just hope we can figure out a way to manage our way down to it, and that's not going to be easy. But somehow we have to be able to picture, and some of us fortunate people during lockdown got to see an amazing world without cars and without all of the stuff, you know, kids back on the street again, and neighbors connecting with each other and community growing and that kind of thing. We had this tiny glimpse of what a positive future could look like. So somehow I think the key is to kind of be able to show that, because sort of people have this innate fear of losing what they have. Yeah. You know, I've got all these things and don't take them off me, you know.
Well, the problem is that when people lose it now, they lose everything often.
There
are more people homeless than we've ever had in New Zealand. And when you destroy the welfare state and the safety net, I think it made change harder.
Yeah,
because
oh, that's right.
You don't think about losing your second car.
No.
When you lose your job, you think about losing your home.
Yeah,
you exactly. think about yeah. losing the ability to keep your family together. Think of what happens to children who have to move two or three times a year because of the cost of housing.
Yeah,
because of the inability to have a home.
Yeah, no, clearly that inequality is one of the biggest threats for us and one of the worst things that's come.
It's one of the things that makes it so hard to change, I think.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I agree.
Why isn't there this? Why aren't we talking about this? We talk about homelessness.
Yeah.
And we talk about child poverty. But we really don't talk about inequality. We also we don't talk about the privilege of the billionaires.
No, but I see that right across, Marvin. I see that in the freshwater environmental space as well. We never talk about the causes. We always talk about the symptoms, and where we've got money, we buy ambulances for the bottom of the cliff, and we keep trying to do something about what we see. Never do we look at the act, go back and go, right, we've got to stop the cause of this problem. So I think I see this right across, that the inequality and the environmental space is the same failure is sort of an acceptance that you know, in this country, that dairy farming is the biggest earner, and therefore we can't touch it because it's the key to our wealth and prosperity. And so we'll turn a blind eye to all of these harms, and we'll spend millions of dollars coming up with little ambulances at bottom of cliffs that don't work to try and treat some of the symptoms. And, you know, that's impossible. It's not going to work.
Frankly, in the 70s, you had many more choices. We didn't have to get rid of everything except dairy farming.
Yeah.
I mean, we send logs overseas as logs.
I know. It's crazy, yeah. Same kind of thing. We send milk powder, so we've got this amazing product, and then we turn it into powder, dry it with coal to turn it into powder, to ship it overseas to become a junk food additive. It's not like we're feeding the world or doing anything positive, and we're just making junk food available, apart from, you know, obviously some good products, butter and cheese and that kind of thing, but they're a very small component of what we make. The rest of it is just junk food additive, and I'm sure there's good money in it, obviously. But it's not as the world becomes more constrained, the choice to eat junk food that contains that is a big part of that market is not going to be it's not going to be around.
One of the interesting things about food is that the cheapest food right now is often junk food, except for vegetarians.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I mean that's all part of the same problem. Yeah.
So, isn't this, when we talk about our environment, don't we also have to talk about politics, culture, and economics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, for sure. It's the polycrisis or the multi-crisis or whatever you want to talk about.
We don't talk about that.
No, well, we don't talk about any of these important things. It's all about sport and the Kardashians.
And you don't have to. You don't have to be super intelligent to know it.
No,
you don't even have. I'm not educated, but I know this, so we can know it if we want to.
Yeah, of course.
Well, if you could, well, let's say you were prime minister, what would you do first?
I would reinstate all of the environmental protections that this government's in the process of throwing out at the moment. I mean, many years of working on the National Policy Statement for Freshwater that they're throwing out, the RMA that they're throwing out, all of these, the treaty principles, all of the good things that we had, they're in the process of chucking out. So getting them all back again would be my first priority, and then ending the subsidies on intensive farming, so making all The user pays, which is so much part of capitalism, but that it never gets applied, in reality. So the user should be paying for all the harm that's done from whatever the product is that you take. I'd want to see the embodied emissions and the embodied energy added to all of the stuff that we import, so that we don't just offshore all of the problems to some other country like China. I could spend all day talking about the things that I would want to change,
Should power have been privatized and
Oh,
dependent on the market?
no, that is just crazy. That is just part of that whole capitalism, that belief that business knows best, even though we've had it shown to us a million times over that business doesn't know best. But there's that. That's just a stupid ideology that they have, that if you privatize it, we'll all be better off. And so then you get, multiple electricity companies all wanting to make their own profits and have their own boards and their own managers. And a simple nationalized
The
electricity
electricity
system would be
generators
better
actually
off.
make more money when there's a crisis. When
Yeah, that's
it
right.
doesn't work, they make more money.
Oh, that's the same. You're seeing that with the Hormuz stuff, the companies that make profits from war, from harm, it's all another part of the flawed system.
Should education be changed? I mean, why aren't we asking the right questions?
I don't know. I mean, I guess in the world that I'm in at the university, we do ask these questions, but it's a self-selected group of people that are coming along to be part of it, not the general public. So I really, I don't know how we get, the average New Zealander involved in these conversations. It's
Of course, the
so
average
far
New
outside.
Zealander can't really afford to go to university,
No,
you know.
totally. That's right.
And the other thing is, if they do afford it, they have to have huge loans. And huge loans are a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways,
Yeah,
because you have
well.
to pay back those loans. And how do you pay them back? You make as much money as possible, even if it means going overseas.
Yeah, but I mean, we've kind of turned our universities into money making again by almost privatizing the universities. We turn them into profit makers rather than, they should be giving to the community. They should be part of the community. And
Well, for
I've
instance,
seen how it can work.
if doctors or nurses or teachers had a free education and even help with their living expenses while getting their education, they might feel like they owe, they often do feel like they own something to society. I mean, they might feel even stronger sense of obligation to society.
Yeah, for
So
sure. I mean, yeah,
education
cube.
should be a part of the process of encouraging mutual obligation.
Exactly.
So basically, I don't, whatever happens is going to be difficult, but basically, we need to turn around our culture.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it needs to be radical, massive change, not some tweaking thing. We have to really change.
And I think we're capable of. I don't know if it'll happen. I suspect it won't, but I know that that we are capable.
I agree. Yeah, we've
And
shown
most
it.
people care. I mean, during the for 2 years, I walked with citizens of Dunedin who were walking beside Palestinians, and this is about caring, about empathy. Just ordinary people, most cases.
No, I agree. There's most people are good. It's the bad ones that seem to end up running things. That's the problem.
Don't know how you do that. I mean, how you deal with that. But I do believe that human beings have good instincts as well as not so good instincts, and how do we encourage that? I know I'm
Definitely.
asking more questions than I'm
No, yeah, I think we're it's just it's a I think about it all the time, and I don't know the answer.
But I guess I'm hopeful in spite of everything because of I know we can do really bad things. I mean, it was a very shock. I've probably never had as big a shock as when the Jewish people in Israel started genocide. But I still believe that we can do better. And even the reaction against what was happening to the Palestinians by younger people all over the world and by ordinary people in Dunedin and New Zealand gives me hope.
Yeah, I agree.
What do you hope for in the next 5 minutes?
Well, yeah, I just hope we come to our senses before it's too late. I hope that that we don't get caught up in this further delusion that all we need to do is to switch to renewable energy, as if we can, you know, because the problem is, and I've kind of written about this in my thing called the Electrifying the Titanic, you know, the idea that kind of if you take the Titanic and if you swapped out that horrible coal-fired polluting, you know, engine on the Titanic and replaced it with an electric one powered by renewable energy from somewhere, it's still going to hit the iceberg. So that the climate change makes gets so much coverage, you know, not that it gets enough, but it gets more than any of the other environmental issues, and we have a raft of existential crises. The planetary boundaries are just one example of it, where we've completely overshot the ability of the planet to be able to absorb our impacts. And so, if we concentrate on this energy thing, then we're just going to make it worse for the planet. I'm not saying carry on burning fossil fuels, but trying to switch to renewables will entail burning lots more fossil fuels to create the infrastructure to try and do that. And so we have our eyes off the rest of the things that are coming at us. And so we're going to hit the iceberg while we're all down in the engine room trying to electrify the coal-powered steam engine in the ship. And so that's the dilemma I see. And of course, it's so popular. It's so if you run around saying, "Well, we all just need to rewire and we'll be all right," then people want to hear that kind of news. And I think it's worse than denialism in that people think that this change is happening, even though it clearly is not. But they think that they can, that means that we can carry on. So the imperative to change is lost through this delusional solution, which isn't a solution. We don't. There is no. It's a dilemma. It's a. There isn't just one solution to the problems that we face. It's overshoot is the problem, and unless we stop overshooting the planet, then fixing one little part of it, like climate change, will not get us anywhere. We have to fix everything, and the only way we fix everything is to drastically reduce consumption and the lifestyles we lead.
If most of us live in cities, we can go, or large towns. If most of us, I mean, you could have a society where most people didn't own cars. If you wanted a car, you could rent one for a short time.
Yeah, no, I know lots of people who don't have cars, yeah.
I mean, you could have a society without cars, and depending on renting them, if you really need one for say wanted a car for 2 weeks, you could rent it from the government or wherever. But the rest of the time, you'd be taking your bicycle, or you'd be taking buses and trains.
Yeah, no,
And
totally. Yeah.
wouldn't that in itself not only cut back on carbon, but it would cut back on batteries, it cut back on steel, and
But I think.
your buses could don't have to run on batteries. They could run on overhead wires.
Yeah, but that's but I think you missed my point, Marvin, that we could all be in public transport. That's just one part of the problem. All that would fix
The energy.
the maybe part of the small part of the climate problem, but that hasn't that
But also
polluted
buses.
rivers and the methane emissions from our cows and the fished out oceans and the deforestation and all of these other
We
things that are
could become
happening won't change.
vegetarians.
Yeah, I know that, but that's the kind of level of change we need. It's not just fixing public transport. It has to be, way, way bigger than that. That's the trap that we get into is the carbon myopia, where we only see one problem, and that's climate, when actually there are a truckload of problems that are all symptoms, and including climate change, of overshoot.
Well, that's why I think our culture has to change. Our
For
culture
sure.
and our economics.
And I've said before that if we replaced all of the economists that are involved in government and that the government turns to with ecologists, then we might start to get heading in the right direction. I
Well,
just sack
I
all the
was,
economists and
from
replace them
my
with
experience
ecologists.
of what economists have done in the last 40 years, I'd have to agree with you. Okay, thanks a lot for
Okay.
coming on.
No worries.
It's been
Thanks, Marvin.
good discussion.
Yeah, cheers.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.